Hoy again. I don't think I need to tell you who it is sitting on my right, but I will tell you that also that what an honor and thrill it is to have Justice Sandra Day O'Connor with us here this morning. First woman to ever be appointed to the Supreme Court of the United States. It only took us 191 years to realize that how important it was to have a woman there. Although she's retired from the Supreme Court now, you can see she's not retired from doing a lot of work. We appreciate your coming.
It's my pleasure and my privilege to be here. I like this state very much.
Okay, Mr. Richardson, whenever you're ready. Ms. Richardson, I'm sorry.
May it please the court, my name is Ross Richardson and I am representing appellant in Wareham in this matter. Mr. Wareham's sentence was artificially inflated by several sentencing errors by the district court. First and foremost, the loss calculations with regard to the Zambian pipeline fraud and the foreign victims was procedurally flawed because the court did not make any factual findings with respect to the loss calculations, nor did the court explain its findings. If you look at the record and the way that the loss calculations were analyzed and argued by the parties, the district court first starts talking about a guideline enhancement having to do with crimes outside of the United States. That's a two-level enhancement that has nothing to do with either the pipeline fraud or foreign victims. The court announces that that's what it wants to talk about. And then the parties begin to sort of go back and forth, and the conversation starts to go into information about the foreign victims. The pipeline fraud is never mentioned at all. When all of this is over, the court then says, I'm going to buy the government's argument, and finds that the loss amount is $9.4 million, which includes the pipeline fraud and the foreign victims fraud. So even though the court never even mentioned the pipeline fraud, and it was never even discussed in that time period, he included it and simply said, I am going to buy the government's argument. Under this court's jurisprudence, that is simply not enough. Without making factual findings, that's not enough information for this court to determine what argument did the court buy. He says, I'm buying the government's argument. Is he buying the government's argument about...
But the court, no, the court did talk about a phone call in which your client asked for a cut of the pipeline money.
That was, yes, sir, you're right, and that was later on when they're talking about... It's not in the same time that
It was at the sentencing hearing, wasn't it?
It was at the sentencing hearing.
Okay, so the court, do you acknowledge that the court was aware of the fact that your client had asked for a cut of the pipeline scam money?
Certainly. He did ask for a cut of the pipeline money, but I think when you look at the absence of factual findings and absence of explanation here, when you look at the pipeline fraud, the reasons that we need that sort of stand in stark relief, because the only evidence about what Mr. Wareham knew about pipeline fraud are from the government's own witness
He knew it in undisputed in the record. I mean, I mean undisputed, but it's in the record. He asked for a cut of the money and was told he would get a cut.
He found out about the pipeline fraud about a year after it was over.
My question is, did he ask for a cut of the money?
Yes, sir, but...
And he was told he would get a cut of the money?
He was told he might get a cut of the money if there were future payments or whatever. That's exactly right. The problem is it doesn't really go to his whether it's reasonably foreseeable that that fraud would have occurred by Mr. Wareham, because he didn't even know about it until about a year after it was over.
Let me ask you a question. You argue that the loss calculation here should have been $1.8 million, not $9.5 million. But the sentence was below even the low end in the guidelines for a loss of $1.8 million. I mean, it seems harmless to me, because no matter what, it was at the low end of even what you argued for. So what are we worried about here?
Well, I think that's the argument the government makes as well.
Well, it's a pretty good argument. I want to know your response.
My response is, you always have to start with a correct guideline calculation. And while the government does say that basically the court may have made these findings, maybe they were incorrect, but then he varied downward and so there's no harm. Except when you look at the court's determination about why he made the variance, the reasons he gives have almost nothing to do with the loss calculation. He talks about the fact that Mr. Inwarum very quickly acknowledged his responsibility to the Amsterdam police. He talks about the fact that he was a bit player, not his actions were not a big part of the conspiracy, and goes from
well, even if the court gave you everything you wanted, would it change anything at all?
Well, if you're going, I think I figured out that the variance that the court gave was about a 47% variance.
And if he was ordered to pay $50 a month for this well over $1 million loss. I mean, it's never going to get repaid. I mean, what I just am trying to see if there's any practical reality to giving you everything you want. I don't see how it changes anything.
Well, let me sort of start with the first question. In terms of the variance, because the court varied 47% down from the 188, if you start from the correct guideline, which is 108, and you vary 47% down from that, then the sentence is, I think, 58 months. So there is a very significant difference if once you start with the correct guideline. In terms of the restitution and talking about the loss amount, and whether $9.4 million will get paid. I think the point there really has more to do with the fact that that was an order that never could have been made to begin with, because the MVRA does not allow you to include relevant conduct in the determination of what the restitution amount is. So that's why that is argued, and that's the difference.
Do you assert that your client is not in the conspiracy as far as the oral timeline?
That's exactly right, and that's because it occurred before he even ever knew about it. And
well, those acts occurred, but isn't it just a fortuity that more money wasn't taken in by way of the pipeline scam? Your client thought more money was going to come. He wanted a cut of it.
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not certain that he wanted a cut of, I think he was asking for money that had been made rather than, but you're right, certainly Mr. Okoji is saying, you might get a cut of future payments. Of course, there were never any future payments because the...
No, that's not correct. He didn't say you might get some testimony if this was 982. Okay, but as you told him, if in the future they paid more money, he could have some of it, right? Yes, I did. I might, could.
Okay, he could, but I guess you're exactly right. The issue, though, I think, is that that fraud was over at that time, and had ended in sometime in 2006.
No, that fraud was over as to those victims on the pipeline scam. But there's no indication that the pipeline scam would not continue.
I guess there's no evidence that it did continue, though.
Let's talk about, but your client thought it was going to, because he wanted some of the money, and was satisfied apparently that he was going to get some of the money that's going to be made in the future. Isn't that correct?
Well, I think again, Mr. Okoji is sort of placating him and saying, well, if their future payments are made, but there's no...
Put on it, but that the testimony is, the testimony is I told him in the future, he found out about it, he asked me for some money, and I said, if you make some more money, you can have some.
But they never made any more money, and I think at that time, Okoji knew that they wouldn't make any more money because that was over.
Your client didn't know that. And it's based on, he can be, a person is held responsible for a conspiracy for loss or foreseeability, correct?
I think that's right, and I think if it had continued from then, we would be in a much weaker position.
Well, let me say this, if a person can be held responsible for foreseeability, what about an explicit understanding that any money in the future, they'll have some of? That seems to be stronger than foreseeability. It's an explicit understanding about money coming in. Seems to be that puts him right in the middle of that conspiracy for law purposes.
I guess when the action has already occurred, if it were something that happened after that agreement was made, we would be in a much more difficult position. But when all of the evidence shows that he had no knowledge of that when it was going on, and that he didn't even find out until well after, a year after it was over, it doesn't seem...
But you were saying when it was going on, you lived in the pipeline scam. To those victims, your client thought that the scam would continue on. He was placated by getting money in the future. If he thought there was going to be no more scam, he would have said, no, you're not going to do it anymore. Give me some of the money you already have. He was completely placated by the fact he would get some money in the future. So he thought the scam was going to continue.
Well, I think certainly the scam had stopped by that point. I think we just don't know anything about what might or might not have occurred. To me, it reads as more of a placating type statement, but there's no evidence that the scam was going on between after it stopped in 06. There's no indication, and we know that it didn't go after that because they were arrested.
As to the possibility of your client getting money from the pipeline scam, did he take any steps to disassociate himself from that scam?
Well, I think it was already over at that point.
I know, but I'm asking, did he take any steps? Did he say, I don't have anything to do with that scam? If money comes in, I don't want any money? Did he do anything like that?
He did not do anything like that, but I think that nothing sort of occurred.
Well, I understand your point. Your point is that activity.
Right. At any rate, so when you look at the pipeline fraud and you look at the evidence in the case, the court doesn't make any factual findings at all, so we can't really tell what the court found or thought about the credibility of the witnesses. But I do believe that on this record, you can't find that he reasonably foresaw or agreed to the scope of the conduct with the pipeline fraud.
Before you run out of time, would you discuss whether the findings were sufficient with regard to relevant conduct?
When you look at relevant conduct, again, when you want to assess relevant conduct against a co-conspirator, you've got to, again, look at the reasonable foreseeability of the co-conspirator's actions and the scope of what they agreed to. And again, the problem here is that we just have no findings at all. As this court said in Carter and again more recently in Wilkinson, the court has to explain its findings. It has to make findings and explain them, and there simply aren't any findings here. And there's nothing in what the government put up in Inspector McGowan's testimony, but none of his testimony goes to any of the decisions or determinations that the court was making. So you can't even look into Inspector McGowan's testimony and say, okay, well, this is what the court was relying on. It's just simply insufficient here.
But isn't it clear the judge knew about the pipeline scam? I understand your legal theory of that it was over, but he apparently didn't accept it. Because at the point of the argument about that, the court spoke of it and said, I remember, wasn't that on a phone call where he wanted some of that money?
Right.
Isn't it clear that the judge clearly knew that your client had asked for money in that pipeline scam?
Your Honor, you're exactly right. And I'm not arguing that Judge Mullen didn't know about it. What I'm saying is when you read the exact passage that you're talking about, you can sort of see them go back and forth, and there are just simply no findings made. He does
but it's not clearly implicit that he adopts the loss findings. Those loss findings include the pipeline scam numbers. And it's clear from his sentencing when people argue to him on both sides, he knows specifically, and he says that before he adopts the government's theory. Isn't that absolutely clear?
Well, but that's not enough, Your Honor, not under Carter and not under Wilkinson. This is the type of sentencing transcript I might have seen, you know, in the years up to Carter. But
So you would have to send it back to him, and he would say, where I said that in the transcript before, let me make it perfectly clear, I'm adopting those loss numbers as to the pipeline scam.
Well, if it's remanded for resentencing, this court should direct that the pipeline fraud not be included because there's no evidence in the record.
That's your legal theory on that. Leave that aside. As far as we're now talking about the sufficiency of the findings, if we were to find that your theory is not correct and that your client could be charged with losses under the pipeline scam, then you would have us remand on the sufficiency of the findings for the court to say, where I said that before, let me make it perfectly clear, he was involved in that. That one sentence would be enough.
I think you've actually got to go farther than that, but I certainly understand what the court is saying. And this court has actually done that in several cases. And said, we can't tell what.
This court has also not done that. If it's clear that the judge knew about the facts and referenced the facts, this court has found that that's enough.
But even if you assume that this the question about whether you can get some future code of conduct that may occur, even if you assume that that is knowledge or that is an appreciation of the fact that the client was connected to that, there's still no findings about what's the scope of the agreement and what, you know, how that is wrapped in as relevant conduct. You can't, well, I think you're exactly right that the court knew about the pipeline fraud. We just don't know what weight, what argument it found convincing. We don't know what weight the court gave it. I think this is one of the, to just say, I'm going to buy the government's argument here. I'm thinking in the cases post-Carter, this is one of the ones with the sort of least amount of information that I've seen that was not, that the court said was okay and that we can understand what the district court meant. And I see I'm out of time.
Let's hear from Mr. Goodman.
May it please the court, my name is Dan Goodman. I'm with the United States Department of Justice, representing the appellee, the United States of America. The district court did not commit procedural error when it calculated NLRM's advisory guidelines range as 188 to 235 months of imprisonment before the court granted a substantial downward variance and sentenced NLRM to 108 months of imprisonment. The district court did not clearly err when it included the advance fee fraud loss incurred by victims Hansel and Bold in its calculation of NLRM's loss amount. I do not agree with the characterization of this as a separate pipeline scam, Your Honor. We think this was part of the same advance fee fraud conspiracy. The conspirators, including Mr. NLRM,
you just see that as one large conspiracy, and that was just part of the activity under the conspiracy.
That is correct, Your Honor. There were several different formats that the conspirators used to target the individual victims, and that's part of what made this fraud so pernicious. With Mr. Zolato, it's a victim. They knew that he had lost a business acquaintance during the 9/11 attacks. And they used the so-called inheritance.
How does Mr. NLRM be held responsible under your theory for the pipeline scam, and were there sufficient facts by the district court to avoid procedural error on holding him responsible?
Yes, again, we wouldn't refer to it as a separate pipeline scam, but we would refer to it as contract format of the advance fee fraud.
You keep adding the word separate. I'm not using that word.
All right.
I'm just talking about the pipeline scheme.
All right.
That's part of their conspiracy, I think. But
and we would say that it was reasonably.
I'm not using that word. You use it.
We would say that it was reasonably foreseeable to Mr. NLRM during the time of his participation in the conspiracy that different victims were being told different stories by different conspirators, including Mr. Okoji, and that he learned during his course of conduct when he was in the conspiracy that Mr. Ansel and Bolt were being pitched this contract format fraud by Mr. Okoji. He asked at that point, he learned about it because it was on a USB drive that was actually retrieved from his apartment. I think they fully answered.
Besides knowing about it, what did Mr. NLRM do with regard to the pipeline?
He asked Mr. Okoji if he could have a portion.
Well, what action did he take? Not what question did he ask, but what action did he take?
Well, he didn't take any further specific acts with real estate.
Well, he didn't take the personal, did he? I mean, other than ask a question about it, what act did he make, did he take with regard to pipeline?
Okay. Well, I would say that it was by no means clear that the answer.
No, it's a simple question. What act did he take? Just tell me the act. That's all you got?
No act other than having it on the USB drive, the documents in his own apartment, and asking Mr. Okoji for to cut of any fees from those two victims. But I do not agree with the characterization of the Ansel and Bull victims as being over with, because we saw time and time again with each of the victims in this case that the conspirators would go back to them to get more fees. That, you know, once they begin to get suspicious about where's my money, they say, oh, well,
Mr. Goodman, may I ask you a question?
Surely.
The pre-sentence report specifically excluded the pipeline fraud losses.
Correct, Your Honor.
The government objected to that.
Correct.
And given the dispute, didn't the district court have a duty to explain why it included the pipeline fraud losses? I mean, they just didn't say anything. It was just, are there any indications in the record that the district court thought the lottery inheritance fraud and the pipeline fraud were part of a single conspiracy? It just didn't clear.
Well, I think certainly the government made its position on that extremely clear in the 27-page sentencing memorandum that the government filed, and at the sentencing hearing when Inspector McGowan testified.
Did the district court have an obligation to kind of clarify what it was doing, what it was including pipeline fraud laws?
Well, I think the district court effectively made it 100% clear, because the district court came up with a number, the same number that the government advanced for the total loss amount, the including the relevant conduct, of $9,453,815.29. And that, you add up the totals of all the victims, including victims Ansel and Bull, and it's absolutely clear that the court, when he says, I'm going to accept the government's argument, you know that it includes that, and he has, by reference, incorporated the government's argument, which is very different from this court's case in United States versus Bolden, in which the court said that there was nothing in the record, including the sentencing memorandum, that explained the fraud loss calculation. Here we know down to the very last penny how the amount of loss was calculated in the district court.
But is it enough for the district court to agree with the math? Aren't we talking about findings with regard to what was agreed to be undertaken and what was foreseeable? I mean, just because he agrees with the math doesn't mean the answer to the other question is adequate.
Well, I think his agreeing with the math, he has to almost implicitly agree with how the that figure was.
But that's the point we're at, is that we're having to imply what his decision was because it's not expressed.
Well, I think there's absolutely enough for this court to review that essentially it's reviewing the district court's adoption of the government's position. Whether the government's position is correct or not is something that the defendant can legitimately dispute, but for the defendant to say that we don't know how the district court came up with that figure, I think that's something of a stretch.
Well, this is the crux on the question of the findings implicit. I think you would have to say the finding is implicit. I think you'd have to say that.
Yes.
We're at that point. But it's more, isn't it more than adopting the numbers? Because now I'm looking at page 1242 and 1243. This is exactly the point at which the objection about the loss calculation is being made. And Mr. Slovinsky says, Your Honor, we would just object to the calculations including Bull and Ansel and the Mundells. The foreseeability issue is a huge issue here. Okoji said Mr. Nwera was not responsible for the Australian pipeline scheme. We think there are two different schemes where Mr. Okoji is obviously the nexus. Then the court says, did Mr. Nwera agitate for a cut of the Australian stuff? Mr. Slovinsky, That's why the agent said, okay, court, no, isn't that what the translator came up with on the phone call? Do I remember that correctly? And then goes on, and the court says, okay. I mean, the court, and then the court says, I'm going to adopt the governor's position on the laws. But the court, that may be implicit, I think it is, but it's pretty clear that he was looking at exactly that loss calculation. He was looking at exactly what Ms. Jennifer's role was in that, because the court clearly said, did he actually take a part cut of that? Now, maybe somebody can say that the court's wrong in that. I think it's factually supported. But isn't that, that leads right into the point where the court then, within two or three sentences, says, I'm going to buy the government's argument and finally going to find the loss amount at $9,100,000. But isn't it at least clear implicitly that the court was focused on exactly the point of foreseeability, just in where it's involved in that part of the scheme?
Absolutely agree with it.
But that is the point that we have to focus on, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that's exactly what distinguishes this case from Holden and the other cases cited by the defendant, where it really was not clear how the district court implicitly or explicitly came up with the number that it did. Here, we know exactly what the district court did. And then, of course, the district court goes on to say, having made that determination with respect to the relevant conduct loss figure, I'm going to do something a little bit different. And the something a little bit different that he did was grant substantial downward variance based on his discomfort with counting some of the foreign loss amount, as well as saying that Mr. Inwarum didn't get enriched from the scheme as much as Mr. Okoji and a couple of the other Section 3553A factors. So I credit the district judge for calculating the advisory guidelines range, what we think is correctly, and then take those concerns in calculating the final sentence with respect to the 3553A factors. Before I get off of Ann's limbo, I do want to say that I think the only thing that prevented them from trying to get more money from them was that they were arrested. The defendants were arrested shortly after that conversation that you read, where Mr. Inwarum asked Mr. Okoji for a cut of the contract fraud payments. By all indications, you know, with every other victim, they kept on getting.
I can't remember. Was there any request for a charge on, was it a trial or guilty
plea? With the Mr. Inwarum, it was definitely a trial.
Was there any request for a charge on multiple conspiracies?
I do not recall one. Certainly they haven't raised that, and as I recall, transcript it was not. More generally, with respect to foreign victims, we do think that it is appropriate in calculating the loss amount to count so-called foreign victims as in calculating the relevant conduct under Guideline 1B1.3A1. There's precious little case law dealing explicitly with that, but I think that the foreign conduct is really just a subset of uncharged conduct, which can be relevant conduct under the Supreme Court's Witte decision. And I think the Seventh Circuit's Dawn decision is very much correct.
I want you to deal with the concept of foreseeability for Ms. Inwarum as it relates to your view of the conspiracy and the pipeline activity. You know, the argument is it wasn't foreseeable that there was going to be any more activity under that scam or that approach. What do you say about that? How's he held responsible? You know, you and I just discussed, we've all just discussed the factual findings, if they were sufficient enough, if in fact the district court agreed with your theory and disagreed with the Mr. Inwarum's theory of foreseeability. What is your theory of foreseeability or fade to disassociate or whatever you might call it, so that Mr. Inwarum can be held responsible for those pipeline loss numbers?
The very language that you read to opposing counsel, where Mr. Okoji tells Mr. Nwera that he could have a kind of at least a future payments from Ms. Brams Limble. I think that shows that both Okoji and Mr. Nwera were contemplating getting additional, or at least attempting to get additional fees out of Ms. Brams Limble. So I think in that sense that it very much was foreseeable. If Mr. Okoji had said, well, you know, we're done with those guys, onto fresh victims, that would be a very different story, but you know.
What if Mr. Okoji, opposing counsel said that they read that as trying to placate Ms. Nwera. What if Mr. Okoji was trying to placate Mr. Nwera, and Mr. Nwera didn't know that? It would still be foreseeable as far as Mr. Nwera. You understand my question?
I think I understand your question, and the way we read the record is that, you know, and where foresaw whether he was being, you know, duped or whether he had a good reason to believe it, but to him it was foreseeable that the conspiracy was going to...
And you think it was foreseeable to him, and this is just what the judge is making, you know, findings or implicit findings or rationale for the determination, but you think that the judge could believe that based on Mr. Nwera's actions, that he didn't say, the heck with that, I want some money, I want my cut for what you've already gotten. And he seemed to be satisfied that he would get some money going forward. Is that strong?
We would certainly agree with that, Your Honor. Yes, Mr. Nwera, you know, certainly didn't come back to and say, you know, how much have Mr. Anselmboa paid now, I want, you know, my 5% of that or whatever. He did seem to be placated by the assurances of Mr. Okoji, and so I think he reasonably anticipated that there was going to be some money from those victims coming to him as well as from any future victims.
If he had information about that specific activity, pipeline in his
apartment? Absolutely. All the documents that were introduced at the sentencing hearing with the Bank of Zambia, the correspondence between Ansel and Bull, they were retrieved from a USB drive that the Dutch police found in Mr. Nwera's apartment. This was, you know, part of the advanced fraud scheme conspiracy that was he had run out of that Amsterdam office. This was not a wholly separate fraud or conspiracy or scam.
Did you ask any of the victims why they sent money under the scam? Why would somebody send millions of dollars to some such entry or inquiry? Did you ask the victims that?
Well, some of those victim stories, when you read them, I mean, yeah, maybe they're gullible at first, but some of them almost make you want to cry because, you know, I think it was Mr. Richardson who was going to give all the money to his church, and you know, at first they sent just a little bit, and then, you know, they told the
story. Yeah, there were others who sent millions of dollars, weren't there?
Well, they start out small, and then, you know, they're told anti-terrorism certificates are necessary, taxes are necessary, legal fees are necessary, and keep being shifted to different names, and you know, they the conspirators strung along the victims as long as they could, and boy, yeah, you want to tell the victims on the one hand, you know, stop already, you learned your lesson, but on the other hand, you want to cry too, because they are so gullible, and of course, like other advanced fee or, you know, telemarketing scams, that they set up, you know, who knows how many hundreds of thousands of solicitations for each victim that they get to bite the bait.
Thank you.
Unless there are any other questions, we respectfully ask the district court's judgment to be affirmed.
All right, thank you, Mr. Goodman. Ms. Richardson, you have some time remaining.
way we read the record in answer to your question, Judge Shedd, I think crystallizes why we need the court to make factual findings and make particularized explanations with regard to sentencing. Because what we're having to do is speculate about what the judge meant and what different types of evidence meant and that type of thing. And I think at this point, post-Carter, post-Wilkinson, that's just not something that this court is allowing to go forward, because this court cannot review it. We're having to speculate about what the court might have considered and what they might not have considered. In terms of the, it was interesting going back to Justice O'Connor's question about
just how can the judge get to that final math amount, that final figure, without including this as a 21-day negative?
I don't know, and I think that, again, I think that you can speculate that that means he included everything, but we just don't know, and I think.
Well, no, the question is, how else could he get there? He either had to buy the government's argument and their theory and adopt those numbers, or else he just pulled a number out of the hat that just happened to match to the cent what the government said their lawsuit was.
I think certainly he adopts the number and he just says, I'll buy your argument, and then picks the number that they've given him. But again, we don't know what argument is he buying and how did he get to
that figure if he doesn't buy everything they've said?
Well, they've made several different types of arguments, and you can't determine whether his determinations were correct or not, because we don't know what he bought. We don't know what argument he bought. So while the government...
Do we presume that the judge acted rationally, or we presume he acted at random and irrationally?
I would imagine that you would presume that the judge would act rationally, but again, in this court's jurisprudence, we don't accept just the court saying, I'm going to buy this argument. We require them to go into these foreseeability and scope questions. And yes, Judge Traxler was asking opposing counsel, what acts did he commit? And I think even if you sort of see this question about, can I have a cut of this money you made, even if that goes to foreseeability, I don't see that there are any acts that took place by my client. And in fact, Mr. Okoji, who has every reason to make my client look bad, to actually testify that he has nothing to do with the pipeline fraud. So there's nothing with regard to the scope that's jointly undertaken. Even if you can say that the cut...
There is a justification that's clear, and I'm soliciting the judge's question, but by accept, there is an argument about the pipeline issue, and I read it to you. Right before the judge accepts the loss numbers, those loss numbers from the government clearly say it's foreseeable and the losses count. And then the judge accepts those numbers. So we do know if the judge accepts those numbers, it clearly would be completely consistent with the government's position on foreseeability and laws. But do you offer some alternative from the record or any way else other than just pure speculation, if any justification, on how the judge got to those exact numbers?
I don't remember that the government actually made any arguments about scope. And what the judge is really wrestling with this entire time is the issue of foreign victims. And in fact, he invites this court to send it back because he feels like he doesn't know what to do. He gives the government two opportunities to go find case law on anything that will allow them
and
to have these.
And you're inviting us to send it back.
I'm inviting you to send it back. That's right. And I would agree with that. But, he's asking the government, show me some case law that allows you, that allows me to pull in these foreign victim losses. And
that's a separate issue from this issue.
That's right. But I'm just saying that is what the court's really wrestling with during most of what the analysis that you're talking about. And in terms of the foreign victim analysis, again, there is no, the foreign victims are not, there's nothing in the guidelines that allows the court to take that into consideration. And yet the court did, and again, we don't know why. So we would ask this court to remand this case for resentencing. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Richardson. We'll come down and recounsel.